And if you have a Bible, turn to me to Revelation chapter 3. Revelation, it's at the end of the Bible. If you hit maps, you're too far. That's a Revelation joke. As you're turning there, as you're scrolling there, or as you're waiting to go there, quick announcement. I've actually been excited to announce this for a bit now. We have selected dates for an upcoming Israel trip. So, if some of you were aware of this, this past January, I spent a couple of weeks in Israel learning how to lead trips to Israel. And we've got some dates. Here are the dates. For those of any of you who are interested, we are going May 11 through 22 of 2020. So this coming Saturday will be like next year, you could be in Israel. And so I want to extend an invitation. If you're interested at all, we're going to do an interest meeting. So the trip will be led by myself and my good friend Jeremy, who is a pastor at one of our sister churches, Fairhaven in Hudsonville. And so if you're at all interested, we're going to have an interest meeting, which will be... Hey, Jared. You're good. Which will be May 19 at 4:00 at South Harbor. So if you're at all interested, come to that and ask whatever questions. It's an interest meeting. And so typically with an interest meeting, it's, okay, what questions do you have? Are you interested? But I also think that if we're going to call it an interest meeting, we should do some stuff that's interesting. So I want to share with you, if you do show up to that, I want to share with you some stuff that I've not shared in a sermon ever, and some stuff I find to be really helpful, especially if we're going to encounter the land and the stories on the ground. Anyway, so we'll do that then. So even if you just want to come for that, that'd be great. But again, it is May 19, 4:00. The trip will be next May, and so plenty of time to prep for that. Sound good? What I want to do this morning is I want to kind of, you'll see, like most weeks when I'm trying to show you something or teach you something or open your eyes or minds to something in the scriptures, I'm trying to do so with pictures and diagrams and maps and things like that. And it's when you're on the ground, it's a little bit easier to understand. It's like trying to explain to someone you love the city you grew up in. It's just easier to take them to that city, right? It's just so much easier to go there and then say, oh yeah, this over here, that's the pond we used to skip rocks, and over there is... So, that's Israel. This morning, I want to tell you a story about a Game of Thrones. Let's go. Do we have any fans of the show? Yeah. All right, yeah. So, I have learned from you Game of Thrones fans... You are quite zealous in your conversion attempts. For the last 8 years, the same people have come to me again and again and said, there's two things that I always hear when it comes to Game of Thrones. Number one is, yeah, you probably shouldn't recommend it from the stage of a church. It's very adult. But, so the same breath, like, don't recommend it. But this show is so good. I hear that all the time. And then that's quickly followed up with, if you're going to watch it though, you got to give it like, a couple of episodes to get into it. Because the first couple episodes, you're getting introduced to all kinds of different characters and family lines. And in fact, somebody told me, if you're really going to watch the show, you need to have like a family tree and a map of the land in front of you for the first couple of episodes. That's how you do Game of Thrones. Am I right, Game of Thronesers? Okay. For the most part. So I'm not going to talk much more about Game of Thrones, that Game of Thrones. But what I have learned is when it comes to the Game of Thrones that I want to show you this morning, it is really helpful to do some of the same kind of work. I need to give you a map. I need to introduce you to some main characters. I need to do some of the hard and potentially a bit like dry work so that when we get to our story of a Game of Thrones, it like starts to make some sense. So let me give you a lay of the land, and then we'll dive in. First, I want to read you a story, and this particular story is from a pastor. It's actually a letter from a pastor to his church, one of the churches he's pastoring, a church in a city called Sardis. So I want to read you the letter. The problem with the letter is it's 2,000 years old, written in another language to people who live in a very different world, as you'll see, a very different world than the world we live in. So then we have to, so we'll read the letter, but in order to understand the letter, we have to back up in about 10 minutes, 15 minutes of painful detail work. I got five things I need you to see so that when we get into the city of Sardis and we can get into the story of a Game of Thrones, that detail work will matter. So stay with me for 15 minutes. Then we have a story about a Game of Thrones. And if we have time, we did in first, we made it work for service. We went over a little bit, not too much. But if we have time, I want to share with you the weirdest story I probably will ever share from the stage of a church. So, if we have time, can't promise. This service tends to be a little antsier. So if I see you getting antsy on me, we'll say amen. We'll be good. But, okay. Once again, for those of you keeping score at home, first a letter, then five pieces of painful 15 minutes background detail, and then a story about a Game of Thrones, and then if we have time, a very weird story. Quite weird story. And remember, all of this is, so since Easter, we've been putting pieces together for a riot, because in the early church, the way the early Christians lived caused a accidental riot in one of the main cities, a city called Ephesus. So next week, we're going to look at the riot. We're just putting together a few pieces, that especially as it has to do with the fertility goddesses of the day. But we're ahead of ourselves. Let's read the letter. Revelation 3, verse 1. To the angel of the church in Sardis write, these are the words of him who holds the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your deeds. You have a reputation of being alive, but you are dead. Wake up. Strengthen what remains and is about to die, for I have found your deeds unfinished in the sight of my God. Remember, therefore, what you have received and have heard. Hold it fast and repent. But if you do not wake up, I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what time I will come to you. Yet, you have a few people in Sardis who have not soiled their clothes. They will walk with me dressed in white, for they are worthy. The one who is victorious will, like them, be dressed in white. I will never blot out the name of that person from the book of life, but will acknowledge that name before my Father and his angels. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So this is a letter written by Pastor John, a pastor named John, to the church in Sardis. But this letter is part of a bigger letter that we call the Book of Revelation. That letter is written to the seven churches, one of which is Sardis, but the seven churches that Pastor John is pastoring. People worked harder back in those days, I guess. Seven churches, it's a lot of churches. So this is written to Sardis. Now, a couple background, five painful background pieces to understand the city of Sardis. The first one is something about the city that you kind of are familiar with. You know somebody who is from Sardis. You know there's somebody who's quite famous that comes out of the city of Sardis. This particularly famous person, he wrote a collection of stories. In fact, he invented a genre of stories. You read these stories in elementary school. The stories gave us phrases like, don't count your chickens before they're hatched. Do you know the statement? It gave us the story of slow and steady wins the race. And the way this particular person would tell these stories is he would bury the stories inside, or he'd bury the truth inside of a story referred to as a fable. So, guy who writes 600 years before the time of Jesus, he writes over 650 fables, and he guesses on his name. Never mind. Aesop. So, Aesop is from Sardis. Now, why do I tell you this? Because the Sardis people were storytelling people. They loved a good story, and especially a good story that reflects some kind of truth. So, the first detail is Aesop. Second detail has to do with roads. John writes a letter that we call Revelation. Seven churches which are connected. It was a circular letter. It would start in one church and it would move to the next church, which would move to the next church. These churches were connected together by a road known as the Royal Road. Sardis is number 5 on the Royal Road. Now, the Romans built the roads. Here's something to know about the Roman roads. Roman roads were well constructed. So Roman roads, Rome built 55,000 miles of roads. If you laid them out, they would cross our globe. Just elaborate roads. You can drive cars to this day down a Roman road. They're functional roads to this day. Now, they don't really encourage that, but you could drive a car down a Roman road to this day. Just think about that. Have we had one year where 131, we haven't had to tear the whole thing apart and put it back together? Like, that's well-constructed roads. This is a Roman road. Now, back to the map. If you notice, we have roads. We have roads. We have the Royal Road, which is that dotted line, which was the mail route. So you'd start the letter, someone would run it up to the next city, then you'd run it up to the next city. You have that road, but then two cities are also off of a road that connects from the sea inland. The two cities are the cities of Ephesus, in which, by the way, there is a massive temple. Tiara talked us through it last week. And a riot breaks out there, which we're going next week. And then the other city is the city of Sardis. It also is connected. So these are strategic locations. Now, why a Roman road? Why build roads? A couple reasons. It was good for trade. You could trade stuff, make money. But the main reason that Rome would build roads is because they wanted to move their military in and out. They needed a quick, fast, efficient way to conquer a nation. So you build a road, and then you can bring in your military. Now, the point of the roads was, it was a new technology, and it was about force or intimidation. However, Jesus, Jewish rabbi, gets on a hill with his 11 remaining disciples. Judas is out, 11 guys left, and he says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, you go and make disciples of all nations." Guess what roads the Christians took? The Roman roads. Had the Romans not built the road systems, the early Christians, how do they get across the world? So what they intended for evil, for corruption, for power, for control, God intends for life. And for good news, in the old country, they would say, "That'll preach." Right? What God intends for evil, what they intend for evil, God intends for good. Think about like technology today. We think of technology, and we'll often we'll get really anxious about technology like the internet, a new road system that allows a message to go out across the world that can be used for all kinds of evil. But as Christians, we can look at those things and say, I wonder what God could do with this. Paul, one of the first Christian missionaries, in a letter called Galatians, he writes to a church in Galatia. Paul says that when the set time had fully come, God sent his son. One of the reasons this is the set time is because Rome had built the roads for the gospel to go. Anyway, that's number, what is that, two, three? Two. I told you it's painful. Third detail. Okay, so we have Aesop and storytelling. Then we have roads. Number three, something about layout. The city of Sardis, I want you to mentally picture the city of Sardis. I can't take you there, but let's get a mental picture in place. City of Sardis essentially has three parts to the city. There is the lower Acropolis. The lower Acropolis is the business district. To your right in the screen is a gymnasium. And then if you were to go a little bit further to the right, you have, there's a synagogue, you have several businesses. This is the shopping mall of the day, right? This is downtown, lower Acropolis. Then you have, up in the mountains, you have the upper Acropolis. Memorize that picture, upper Acropolis. Around the upper Acropolis, I'll take you there in a moment, there is a wall. Behind the wall is where the king would live. Sardis was the capital of the Lydian Empire for a long time. So kings lived here. It was along the royal road. So behind that was the king and people of power and privilege, the wealthy. Okay, so you have the Acropolis. Then if you're standing looking at the Acropolis here, if you're standing on the royal road with the lower Acropolis behind you and you're looking up, to your left, you're going to see the upper Acropolis, kings, money, power. To your right, you're going to see the Necropolis. The people of Sardis are obsessed with death to the point where we have excavated 10 million tombs. I was on the tour bus a couple years ago. I was on my way to Sardis as a tourist. And there's that little bell thing when you want to get whoever the tour guide is to know that you have a question. So I rung my little bell and he says, "Yeah, can I help you?" And I said, "I got a question. What are all the round hill things? Are there aliens here? What's going on?" And he said, "No, those are tombs of important people. There are 10 million of these tombs. They look like rounded mini pyramids. because they are obsessed with death so much so that they dedicate an entire portion of the city called a necropolis to death. Pastor John writes a letter to the church in Sardis, and he says, by the way, look at these two side by side. When you look at them, they almost look identical. Almost identical. Pastor John writes a letter and he says, I know your deeds. You have a reputation of being alive, but you are dead. We don't know for sure that this is what he's referring to. It's a great picture though. You have a reputation of looking like this, but you're actually like this. You know how to put on a show for everyone who comes across. They think you're super spiritual. And this, he is just such a good man. She is just such a good woman. You have that reputation, but actually you're more like this. That'll preach. We don't have time to actually preach any of this stuff. I'm just giving you details. Okay, next one. Fourth, earthquake. There is in 17 AD, during the life of Jesus, so this is during the life of Jesus, there is an earthquake that hits in this area, and it mostly affects the city of Sardis. It's massive. It's a 10 on the Richter scale. I'm not an earthquake guy. I wouldn't know what that means, so I had to look it up. In 2010, do you remember the earthquake that hit Haiti? That earthquake was a 7 on the Richter scale, which I'm told is 1,000 times, I don't understand how that math works, but 1,000 times smaller than the one that hit in 17 AD. 1,000 times. That, in 2010, the earthquake that hit Haiti leveled the country. This one is 1,000 times stronger. So much so that the first century historian named Pliny the Elder describes the earthquake, and he says that it was the worst earthquake in human memory. Pastor John writes a letter. We call it Revelation. We often think of Revelation, and it's like, people either overly love Revelation, or they're a little like, okay, you're a little bit, or it's like, people are like, I'm scared of Revelation. I don't want to touch that thing. That thing's weird. Because we think that Revelation is, it's either like this book of codes and like dragons and warlocks or whatever, Gog and Magog. I don't know. And people will either be like, yeah, but you know who the Antichrist is. And then it's whatever person they're not voting for. Or, you know, right? Like that tends to be how some people have read Revelation. And other people have said, no, I don't, you know, I know I don't get it. So I'm just going to stay away from that thing. Pastor John writes a letter to 7 churches. He begins the letter by saying, blessed are you, those of you who receive this letter, and do it. Like chapter 1. They are from Sardis. Notice what he says to them in chapter 16 in his letter. Then there came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a severe earthquake. Pliny the Elder, Roman historian, Pliny the Elder described the earthquake, and I quote, as the worst earthquake in human memory. Pastor John writes, no earthquake like it has ever occurred since mankind has been on earth. So tremendous was the quake. Almost verbatim. But then notice what he says next. The great city split into 3 parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. The upper Acropolis and the lower Acropolis, we believe, used to be one city. We believe that because there's a building on the top and the half of the building is on the bottom. We believe that the city was destroyed in the earthquake and that the city actually split. The upper Acropolis and the lower Acropolis, the business district, split in an earthquake. You see how this is not like just random history? Like this, it's like, okay, that's 4th detail. By the way, you can Wikipedia this. It's been there the whole time. Like, it's not hiding from us. Fifth detail. Aesop, roads, layout, earthquake, and then finally, vineyards. The city of Sardis sits in a mountain range known as the Tmolus Mountains. The upper Acropolis, remember that picture? So upper Acropolis sits here. Then you have the lower Acropolis, which we believe kind of broke. And then there's a valley in between them with another valley between the Acropolis and the Necropolis. This valley, these valleys are perfect conditions to grow grapes. And the ancient people, and I think we could dare wager people today, loved their grapes. Why would they love their grapes? Wine! This becomes wine country. It was said that the wine of Sardis is the most delicious wine in the world. In fact, the god of wine, the ancient god of wine, a god who goes by the name Dionysus, he has grapes for hair. Dionysus. That'd be really uncomfortable if it got sunny. Then you'd have raisins for hair. Yeah. Grapes for hair. Dionysus, god of wine, his myth, his legend comes out of Sardis. The legend goes that he grew up in Sardis. Now, with all those pieces, are you with me so far? I know it's boring. He's still there. Okay. Hey, I need to tell you a story about a Game of Thrones. Now, this particular story begins wrapped up in the myth of Dionysus. So it kind of begins inside of the story of Dionysus is another myth, a bigger myth, a myth that is just about the city of Sardis. But before we go there, how many of you recognize this man? Don't tell us how you feel about him. Just, you recognize him. President Trump. Now, I don't want to tell you a story about the Game of Thrones that is our current political system. I don't want to, there is its own Game of Thrones in our own system, as there always has been. The reason I show you this picture is because a couple years ago, President Donald Trump wrote a book. He co-authored a book called The Midas Touch, or Midas Touch. Which is an interesting thing to call a book. You've heard this phrase, Midas Touch, haven't you? The idea behind the Midas Touch is everything you touch, if you have the Midas Touch, turns to gold. So, if you have teenage kids, grab their headphones, listen to whatever rap song they're listening to, and you'll hear rappers singing about the Midas Touch. If you follow sports, listen closely to the commentators, and you'll hear them every once in a while refer to someone as having the Midas Touch. A couple years ago, I believe it was the cover of either Sports Illustrated or ESPN magazine, Usain Bolt, remember him? Fastest man ever. He had two rings, and they said Midas Touch, and he was right on the cover of the magazine. Midas Touch is, okay, let me tell you the myth. Here's the story. Once upon a time, in Sardis, a land far, far away, Sardis, it sits along the royal road, and it has a road coming in from the bay. Once upon a time, in Sardis, there was a king. His name was Midas. King Midas, one day, was walking up and down his vineyards, and out of the vineyard, he sees a hoof, and he realizes that there is someone passed out in his vineyard. They had partied a little too hard. They had drank a little bit too much. And the thing passed out in his vineyard was a satyr. What's a satyr? A satyr is half goat, half human. And the satyr is passed out in his vineyard, drunk in the king's vineyard. By the way, this is a myth. This isn't real. For those of you who are like, does Tim believe in half goat men? No, stories, okay? This is their story. Back to the story. So he sees this half-goat man passed out in his vineyard, and he looks a little closer, and he realizes he knows who the goat man is. It is a quite famous satyr by the name of Silenus. Now, Silenus is best friends with a god named Dionysus, the god of wine. And so King Midas takes Silenus, and he carries him back to his palace. Silenus comes to and says, you've taken care of me. Do you not realize how many people walked by me and left me half dead? How many people, when they saw me, they kicked me and they laughed at me? You took care of me. Come with me. I want to introduce you to my friend. So King Midas and Silenus go back to Dionysus, the god of wine, and Silenus tells Dionysus what has just happened, and he says, this guy took care of me, no one else has. So Dionysus says, okay, because you were good to Silenus, you must have a pure heart. I will grant you whatever wish you want. So King Midas wishes that he would have the power that anything he touched would turn to gold. Hence, we get the name Midas Touch. Now, the story goes on that he goes back to his palace and he sees an apple tree and he touches an apple and the apple turns to gold. And then he sees the tree itself and he touches the trunk of the tree and the whole tree turns to gold. And he's like a kid, like running around, touching things, turning things to gold. Now I have a golden chariot. Now I have a golden horse. You know, like touching everything. Now it's gold. Now it's gold. His daughter sees him like giddy, touching things, and comes out dancing to him and says, "Daddy, what are you doing?" And King Midas grabs his daughter's hands and says, "Come look." But as he's running, he realizes the hand's a bit heavy and he has turned his daughter into gold. So he goes back to Dionysus and he says, "Dionysus, this gift you gave me is a curse. Take it from me. I don't want it. Remove the curse." Dionysus says, "You're a good man. I will remove your gift, your curse. Go and wash in the Pactolus River that runs between the Acropolis and the Necropolis." You now have the mental picture. There's a river that runs called the Pactolus River. Go and wash in the Pactolus River and the gift, the curse, will be removed from you. But, so he does, but as King Midas is walking into the river, everything he touches turns to gold. The stones, the rocks, the sand. And this is why the ancients say there is gold in the Pactolus River. That's the myth. Now, where does the myth bump into history? There was a king, king of Lydia, ancient empire of Lydia, king of Lydia named Croesus. How many of you have heard of the name Croesus? Rich as Croesus, some used to say. How many of you have heard of the show DuckTales? DuckTales, woo, tales of daring, do good and good luck tales, woo. My son loves the show. We have to sing the song. They did an episode in which, or I don't know what this is, but the treasury of Croesus. Croesus, the king of Lydia, what he discovers is if you take a net and you drag that net in the Pactolus River, that you will capture flakes of gold, sometimes rocks of gold, sometimes boulders of gold. Croesus, some have argued, Croesus is the richest human being to ever have lived because he captures the gold. He definitely was the richest of his day. Croesus captures the gold. Now that creates a problem. If you're a rich king, how do you protect your gold? What do rich kings do to protect their stuff? You got to build something. What do you build? You got to build a wall, right? You got to get it. You got to protect it. You need a wall and you need people to guard that wall. So Croesus decides, I got to build a wall. Only I can't build it in the, I gotta build it up on the Acropolis. I need it to be out of reach from people. Gotta build a wall to protect the gold. So he builds a massive wall. This is the wall. Sorry, I took some pictures. Some of these are mine, some of them from the internet, but I was here in 2009 and I was watching a game on TV yesterday and a basketball game from 1995 and just like, why does it look so old? I'm not that old. Like, I don't feel that old, but the game's quality is, did you only have one camera angle in 95? Come on. Anyway, I digress. This is the wall. So that's one of my pictures. You can just look down. Like this is the wall he builds. It's massive. It's intimidating. It's impenetrable. Now we get into our Game of Thrones. An army that was trying to conquer the world. They were called the Persians. At the top of the Persian army is a king by the name of Cyrus. You may know the name Cyrus because he shows up in the Old Testament. Cyrus in the Old Testament is the king who frees the Israelites out of Babylonian captivity. He allows them to go back home. End of Old Testament. Right around the beginning of the New Testament, he sets them free, Cyrus. Cyrus is trying to conquer the world. He gets to Sardis, and he comes up against this wall, and he's stuck. How do I get... A, I want the city, because the city's along the royal road, but it's also along a road that connects to the sea. So it's strategic location. But B, somewhere in those mountains, behind that wall, is King Croesus' gold. So Cyrus calls his generals together, his army, and they encircle, they line up around the wall, and he says to his army, if anyone can figure out how to get behind the wall, I will bless you plenty. You will never be a poor man, and your kids will never know a poor man. So they examine the wall for 14 days. They camp out around the wall, getting fatigued, getting discouraged. How do we take the wall? a general by the name of Heroides. Heroides. He comes up with a plan. Here's his plan. He sees the soldiers up against the wall, marching along the wall. But he watches as one soldier, he looks over the wall and his helmet falls off his head. Then the soldier disappears. And a couple minutes later, the soldier's back on the wall with his helmet on his head again. So Heroides has a theory. There must be a gate somewhere in the wall. Otherwise, how else does he go down and up so fast? It has to be somewhere where the soldier dropped his helmet. So he calls together some of the fiercest, bravest men and some of the warriors, and he waits until nightfall. And then the men sneak up to the little gate, and they discover that the little gate is unguarded. So they enter the gate, and the soldiers are sleeping. This is history. Like, look the story up. Fascinating. They're sleeping. So under the cover of the night, a few strong men wipe out the entire Lydian, King Croesus, his entire military, and they take the city. A helmet falls, leads to the destruction of a city because they're sleeping. Now, 200 years pass, and now the Persians own the city. The Persians are in charge of the city. And so 200 years pass, and there's a new military commander on the scene. His name is Alexander the Great. He is one of the, by the time he was 30, this guy has conquered the world. Like, Alexander the Great, one of the last things he conquers, wants to conquer, is the city of Sardis. He can't get into Sardis. Same problem everyone's had who's trying to get into Sardis. Can't get into Sardis. The wall's too high. And we need Sardis because it sits along the royal road. And there's an inlet that comes off the bay, and there's gold in them hills. So he waits along the base, and very similar, he says to his soldiers, if anyone can get into the, like, someone figure out how to get in past the wall. And it's a soldier by the name of Lagarus who figures out how. Here's how. He observes every once in a while, these Persians would throw bodies of animals over the side of the wall, either old food or maybe it's a sacrificial animal, something, throw them over the wall. And he observes that there is one part in the wall where buzzards would land. So Lagarus has a theory. Birds don't land where people are walking. Birds are afraid of people. If there's buzzards landing on this portion of the wall, it must not be guarded. So under the cover of the night, they come over the wall, and they discover, Alexander and his army discovers, the soldiers are sleeping. And just like before, they wipe out the entire Persian army, and they take the city. Soldier's helmet falls. The city is destroyed. A few birds reveal a weak spot, and the city is destroyed again. Game of Thrones. I remember hearing the story in... Oh, by the way, listen to what John says. Pastor John writes you a letter. You're from Sardis. You're a church. You're a Christian living in Sardis. To the angel of the church in Sardis write, these are the words of him who holds the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your deeds. You have a reputation of being alive, but you are dead. Wake up. Strengthen what remains and is about to die, for I have found your deeds unfinished in the sight of my God. Remember, therefore, what you have received and what you have heard. Hold it fast and repent. But if you do not wake up, I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what time I will come for you. Sardis was the home of kings who fell asleep. To a country, to a people who told stories. The great Aesop was from there. What does John do? He reminds them of their own story. I remember being on the ground and hearing this for the first time, this whole like drama, and it, for me, it like captivated. I love a good military drama, and I was captivated by the drama of the whole story. And then it hit me, of all, because we had done the tours to the seven cities, and of all the cities, this was like stop four or five, I think, of all the cities, this one gave me chills. Because this one, of all the cities, this one felt the closest to home. Like John could write this letter. Pastor John could be pastoring my church, and he could write this letter to my church. Because what you discover in the story of Sardis, Sardis is not written to small, struggling churches. Sardis is not a letter of, here's how you grow your thing, or here's how you... Sardis is not written to small and struggling churches. It's not a letter of, just endure, hang in there, which is a lot of the other letters. Sardis is a letter written to thriving, healthy churches. And Pastor John offers a warning to strong, healthy, thriving churches. And his warning is, be careful. It is really easy when things are going well to let your guard down. This is my 6th year at South Harbor. I'll be my seventh year beginning in November. So 6 times now I've been able to stand in the summer, in August, in the waters of Lake Michigan. And literally, we have baptized hundreds of people in 6 years. And I mean that as literally. We actually have baptized hundreds. Hundreds of people have said, Jesus, I'm in. I love you. I'm in. Every year, I don't know why, I shouldn't be surprised by it, but every year on my drive, like as I'm about to drive home, I sit in the parking lot and I text Tom Ellenboss, our senior pastor, and I text him the same thing every year. Tom, thank you for having the vision of this. Every year, even I get emotional now thinking, every year on the drive home, I find myself crying just because like this is such a gift to be part of a thing that feels a bit like a movement, to be part of something, a church who actually believes in reminding people that they are loved by God, that our God cares for them, that actually invite people to know Jesus, not just know about him, but to know him. I'm just humbled by that every year. And this letter gives me chills because Sardis is written to churches like us, because it's in spaces like this, when things are going well, that it's really easy to let your guard down. And many of you know what this looks like at a very personal level. You had a friend, and you and this friend walked through life together, and you and this friend, you shared stuff with this friend that you hadn't shared with anybody, and this person had been with you through the hard stuff, the really hard stuff, and you were with them in the really hard stuff. And then life happens, and so one of you moves, one of you gets married, one of you whatever, and so you just have some distance. And now every once in a while, you get back together with this friend, but it's like all you do is tell old stories. You don't ever tell new stories. You don't make new stories. And then you go through something, and you need a friend, and just there's just too much water under the bridge. You're too far from each other. Because friendships take work. It's really easy to let our guard down and forget the value of a good friend. Some of you know this in a marriage. You had a spouse and you vowed, you stood on a stage in a church and you made vows and you said, like, I will do anything for you and I will be with you no matter what. And then work got busy and you started having kids and the kids demanded time, and now there's t-ball practice, and then there's soccer practice, and youth group, and you used to do dinners at the table together, and now it's like, okay, quick bite before the TV, and you do this, and you do this, and you and the spouse who vowed your lives, you never intended it. It wasn't like you tried to do that. It's just like, you know, one glass of wine with a coworker is not going to hurt anything. That just one leads to two, and then two leads to three. And before you know it, now you've got this whole thing over here and this spouse that doesn't know you anymore, and your marriage falls. You can tell story after story like that, right? It's the way the enemy works is never, it's usually never loud. It's usually very quiet. It's just, you can go to bed. Like the wall's fine. Like it's stood for hundreds of years. Do you see how high up it is? You're good. And it's just one, like just sleep on it and the enemy sneaks. So you know what this is like in your faith? It's you go on the mission trip, you hear the song, you hear a sermon, whatever it is, and you promise Jesus that you're going to talk to him because he's been talking to you. And so you promise, like, I'm going to be deep in prayer. I'm going to be closer, Jesus. I'm going to try to lean into this relationship because I know you've leaned in for me. And then life just happens and life gets busy. And if your life is a lot like my life, the very easiest thing to cut is devotion time, prayer time. It's so easy to cut, right? It's just so easy. Like, I'll 10 minutes, hit snooze one more time and I need the rest. I'm tired, or I'm trying to get back in shape, so I got to go to the gym. I'll carve out time there. And before you know it, you find yourself in a church setting and you're singing songs and you're like, yeah, the band's not what they used to be. Or the sermon, he's not as good as he used to be. and in reality, you don't want to look in the mirror too closely on it. But in the reality, it is, I quit asking Jesus to show up. And so now I find, like, where is that emotion? Where is that? Pastor John writes a letter to a church in a very real world. And the church in Sardis, he has a warning for them. Any moment, the helmet can fall. We got to wake up from comfort, right? How about this one? Appearances can be deceiving. We need to wake up to this too. Like, you have a reputation of being alive, but you are dead. Think about this. Okay, if the soldier who does this and the helmet falls off, how much different would history be if that soldier would have said, I screwed up, guys. I looked over the hill and my helmet fell off. Now, we don't know exactly how that all played out. They probably would have killed him, actually. So ancient cultures did it. But like, had he not, like, gone and snuck down, got his helmet, come back, they would not have revealed the weakness in the wall. The entire empire wouldn't have been crushed overnight. Some of us find ourselves, how do I say this? I've been here 6 years. I've discovered in myself, it gets easier and easier, always does, to, if I tell people this thing, then they know this thing, and now they can potentially use this thing to say hurtful words. So it's just easier not to tell them that thing. You know what I'm talking about? So appearances can be like, yeah, maybe the marriage isn't going great, but I'm not going to say anything about that, because if I say something about that, well, then they know that. And then if we do come, some of you have friends who, like, you need to call it out. So not everyone was here Maundy Thursday. We do it every year. Maundy Thursday, we do we call it testimonies, which is a cheesy name for a very serious moment. If you've been here, you know what I'm talking about. But every year, we have a time where people can text in a burner phone. They can text in God, would you deliver me from? Here's something I'm carrying. Would you help me in this? And then we just kind of share anonymously, like, the postings. And I'm telling you, every year it is, you guys experienced it for the first time. It's really, really powerful. It's really powerful. And it's really sad what some of you have to carry. And every year, it happened again this year, someone will come and set up an appointment. And then we'll say, hey, do you remember the thing that was posted? That was mine. And then my question is always, who else have you told about this? And the response typically is, I haven't told anyone. Listen, you owe it to yourself to not carry that alone. And if you're in pain and your soul is crying out for someone to see you, we need to know that. And if your marriage is struggling and you don't know that you're going to pick up the pieces before it's too late, let somebody in on it. This is John's warning, right? This is John's warning. Because that's when the enemy likes to sneak in. And appearances can ruin us. So John writes a letter to a church in Sardis, and he says, just be very careful. Be very careful. I hope that that South Harbor Church, I hope when people describe us, you know, it'd be a beautiful, like, this is our mission statement. People walk in and you say, well, you know, just tell us about South Harbor. I hope that they say, that's the most messed up church I've ever been to. Like, that dude told me he was an alcoholic. That person over there just said, I'm a porn addict. That person over there, like, they said, yeah, my marriage, we've been trying to fix. Like, they're all messed up people. And yet they're finding ways to do it community together. I find that to be a beautiful vision for the church. I think we have to go to war at on our own hearts that want to protect our own hearts because it's actually killing us. The lie of individualism is killing us. That's my story about a Game of Thrones. So I don't know if I have time to do. Can I give a Cliff Note version of a weird? Okay. It'll be, okay. Here we go. Okay, I'm telling you, it's weird. I don't know if you're going to want to say please when you get through it. It's pretty weird. Okay, so remember the five detail things? So we have the Acropolis, Necropolis, Pactolus River between those. Then you have the lower Acropolis, and you have the vineyards over there. Beyond the city wall, up in the upper Acropolis, you have Croesus' money. You have his temples, you have his palaces. But you also have a massive structure. Let me show you the structure. This is a temple to the goddess Cybele Artemis. This is two goddesses, both goddesses of fertility, smushed together. Cybele, her symbol is a lion. There is another fertility goddess who has a symbol of a lion. We talked about her on Easter. She goes by the name Ishtar, a distant cousin up the street. Okay, so she's got the same idea. But Cybele, symbol of a lion. Artemis, she's got a massive temple, the largest temple in the world, in a city up the street, in a city called Ephesus. A riot breaks out there around this temple. We'll get there next week. This particular temple is the fourth largest in the ancient world. Fourth largest. So it's essentially to the same god, just a few miles away from each other. You have number one and number four temples. Just, that's incredible. Cybele is a big deal. This goes up 8 stories, 134 huge columns. One column is estimated to take 400 years to build. So you teach your son how to do this masonry work, and then he teaches his son, then he teaches his son, then he teaches his son. 400 years, none of you see the temple. But you do it when your son asks you, why do we do this? You say to your son, because Cybele is worth it. This is Cybele Artemis. Now, let me give you a Cybele story. She's the goddess of fertility, symbol of a lion. Here's her myth, the myth of Cybele. This is the early church rises in this culture. This is the myth of Cybele. It's weird. Okay, so she's originally hermaphroditic. I'm going to try to use as coded language as I can. She would reproduce with herself, and so she would make lots of babies. The gods are concerned that maybe she's making too many babies, and if left unchecked, who can stop her? Because she can make a whole army of people. So the gods decide to make sure she can't do that, so they cut off her male organ. Okay, so they... Weird story. Her grandson, a god named Attis, A-T-T-I-S, desires her. He likes her, grandson. And so as a way of paying homage to Cybele, he makes himself a eunuch, if you follow. Then he takes his sacrifice, and out of his sacrifice grows a tree. This is the myth. In some cultures, it's an olive tree. In most cultures, it's a pine tree. Around this tree, you build a temple because they believe that that tree was a tree of life. It was a tree of fertility. So they would build a temple. The courtyard of the temple is known as a timonos. In Greek, it's a paradisos or paradise. So in the paradise of Cybele Artemis is the tree of life. There's a bigger one in Ephesus, in the temple in Ephesus that Tiara mentioned last week. Notice what John says in his letter to Ephesus, also in the book of Revelation. Whoever has ears, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who is victorious, I will give the right to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. Anyway. So, Attis, tree, sacrifice, tree. Now, as worshipers, you want to let Addis know that you understand how important what he did is. And you want to let Kibbalah know that you follow her. Why? Because 1 out of 2 women died in childbirth. 1 out of 2 women died in childbirth. But Kibbalah, the goddess of fertility, says, I'll keep you alive. Just bow down to me. I'll keep you alive. And historically, the records were, she did a pretty okay job at it. Why? Because her priests were doctors, and they had some advanced medicine. They keep people alive. But we know this looking back. They didn't know. They just said, when you go to Kibbalah's temple, she keeps you alive in childbirth. We have to follow Kibbalah. So every year, there was a giant worship celebration that would happen. Here's the worship celebration. It begins in the courtyard, and you would dress in white, especially children would be dressed in white. Think Easter Sunday morning, dressed in like white. You dress in white. I don't know why I gave that as an image. This is a really weird story. Don't think of Easter. Okay, dress in white. And then the priests would come in, and with them, everyone, the crowds would shout, Triumphe, 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 show us yourself, show us, Kibbalah, show up, where are you? And there's different records. One record says that they would hold a 6-foot statue of the sacrifice of Addis. That's one. One said that they would try to conjure up the mystical with fire and smoke. I mean, it gets weird. But eventually they would say that Kibbalah would show up. And then the priests, as you march into the temple, the priests, to take their vows to become a priest, would offer their sacrifice. Now, their sacrifice would mimic or follow the sacrifice of Addis. In other words, they would make themselves eunuchs. Lean over, explain what I'm talking about to who you're with. They would cut it off. That's what they would do. Then they would place that sacrifice, I'm not going to make motions. They would place their sacrifice on an altar. This is the altar. Every year, I was talking to Wally, one of our other pastors, and he's like, yeah, I remember this moment on our trip too. So you have people sitting, because it's the most comfortable seat in the whole area. It's like a flat rock. So you would sit on it, and then, you know, the historian tour guide would be like, and then over here, you would take you put it on the altar. And then every time people would be like, the kids dressed in white wanted to get the blood of the castrated priests on their clothes. Why? Because they wanted to be reminded that Kibbalah looked out for them, would protect them in childbirth. By the way, there's a really twisted verse. I didn't bring this up first service. This is a 11 o'clock edition. I didn't bring this up. In the book of Timothy, there's a really twisted verse where it says, but women will be saved in childbirth. Paul writes to Timothy, his disciple, and Timothy's a pastor in Ephesus where this whole thing's happening, and he says, women will be saved in childbirth. That verse has been totally miscommunicated by a lot of well-intentioned Christians who have said, women, you have to have kids if you want to go to heaven. It's not what Paul's saying. What's Paul saying? In fact, the word in childbirth could be best translated throughout childbirth. What Artemis promises you, what Kibbalah promises you, only God can actually do, which is bring protection. John writes a letter. Pastor John. John writes a letter. These are his words. He says, yet you have a few people in Sardis who have not soiled their clothes. They will walk with me dressed in white, for they are worthy. He who overcomes will, like them, be dressed in white. I will never blot out his name from the book of life, but will acknowledge his name before my Father and his angels. He was an ear. Let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So the question is, did the Christians wake up? Did they do it? John writes a letter. Did they actually do it? One more minute. Let me show you a couple things. This is in the lower Acropolis. You have on a doorway, you have a lion, the symbol of Kibbalah, and it's etched out, and over top of it, someone put a cross. It's like someone is doing business on Main Street, and they realize Kibbalah is a fraud. I don't want my kids covered in the blood of these priests. We don't follow you anymore. And they make a statement on Main Street. Up the street, you have a dye vat, someone with a lot of money. If you have a dye vat, that means you're dyeing things. Lots of money to be made in that trade. And on the divat, you have a cross. But here's the one that, like, oh, this one gave me chills. We saw a picture earlier. Here's the picture again. In the picture of the temple, there is a structure, and it's out of place. Do you see the structure? Any guesses as to what that structure is? It's a early Byzantine church. Now, Christianity was legalized in the Roman world by an Edict of Milan in 313. This is from the late 300s. So Christianity is legal. But, you know when worship of Kibla Artemis was on its heyday? This time period. Did they do it? John says, keep your clothes white if you live in Sardis. Did they do it? Look how close it is. Let me take you closer. It's literally next in the temple courtyard. Did they do it? Here's what's possible when you live in Sardis. It is possible in Sardis to think, if I have to keep my clothes white, you know what I need to do is I need to avoid all those people with all the problems. They're the problems. I got to keep all the people that drink too much out of my life. I got to keep all the people that use the wrong language out of my life. I got to keep all the people. I got to keep my walls wide. Keep them a distance from me. That's not what these Christians thought. They said, if there's children who are covered in blood, we want to be next door to that. We want to be there to heal them. We want to be there to tell them a better story. And they put the church next door. This story gives me chills. I'm out of time. Would you pray with me? Lord, give us the passion of our spiritual ancestors who recognize that when you ask us to keep our clothes white, to not soil our clothes, you are not asking us to not touch those who are hurting. Lord, give us that passion. Lord, I pray for anyone who is in a marriage that needs to wake up or a friendship that needs to wake up. Or Lord, if you are speaking to anyone's heart and saying, hey, something in you needs to be breathed back to life. Lord, I pray that this morning we would listen. Lord, that we would follow. And in so doing, Lord, I pray that you would open our eyes to see the world that you see. So Jesus, we love you and we pray this in your name. And everybody said, amen. Would you please stand?